This is the BBC.
Welcome to the Week in Westminster podcast with me, Tom Newton-Dunn from The Sun. On historic 7 days as the PM triggered Article 50 and terrorism again loomed large with a row over encryption. 9 months, 5 days and 8 hours later, it finally happened. On Wednesday, Theresa May broke the news to the House of Commons that we all knew had been coming since the EU referendum result became clear just after dawn on the 24th of June last year. But it still didn't feel any less of a big moment.
A few minutes ago in Brussels, the United Kingdom's permanent representative to the EU handed a letter to the President of the European Council on my behalf, confirming the government's decision to invoke Article 50 of the Treaty on European Union. The Article 50 process is now underway, and in accordance with the wishes of the British people, the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union. This is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back.
It was the biggest single development a British Prime Minister had informed Parliament about in at least a generation. For some MPs listening, the triggering of Article 50 Brexit talks was a moment of great celebration, the culmination of their whole political careers. A Conservative, Jacob Rees-Mogg, even deigned to quote Sir Francis Drake.
There must be a beginning of any great matter, but the continuing unto the end, until it be thoroughly finished, yield the true glory. May I wish my right honourable friend good luck and good fortune in her negotiations until she comes to true glory and is welcomed back to this House as a 21st century Gloriana.
But for others, it was heartbreaking, the collapse of a grand dream. The unfortunate man whose job it was to receive the letter, EU Council President Donald Tusk, sounded one of the saddest of all.
We already miss you. Thank you and goodbye.
The sheer scale of what Brexit involves also became clearer this week. Even before the EU's difficult first formal response, Theresa May described the task of striking the right deal in just 2 years as momentous. But Britain's political dealings with Europe weren't always as troubled. First this week, we go back to where it all began. Two Euro grandees, former Deputy Prime Minister Lord Heseltine and former EU Commissioner Lord Hill, came in to explain how Britain's involvement in the grand project from the 1st of January 1973 first came about and where they think it went wrong. First, Lord Heseltine, a founding Tory Europhile who remembers Luftwaffe air raids only too well.
I was there doing the bombing and I remember what it was like to be alone. We were sovereign, but we didn't have much power.
The bombing?
The bombing is in Swansea in the 1940s. I remember vividly the emotions that prevailed in so encouraging the European movement of the 1940s. It was the men and women of the resistance movements and the prisoner of war camps who said it must never happen again. We must create institutions in Europe to pacify the continent, to stop the slaughter. After there had been 3 Franco-German wars in 3/4 of a century, 2 of them we'd become deeply involved with huge casualties. I remember the disappointment when Jean Monnet and the other European fathers offered us the leadership of Europe and said, look, you are the victors. You're the ones who must now show us. Of course, we turned it down. And they created the Common Agricultural Policy and the Schuman Plan and other European institutions. And we stood apart. Indeed, we tried to compete with them. We created the European Free Trade Area. But within a very short period of time, members of that wanted to join the European Union, and then we ourselves joined.
But it wasn't just a pragmatic economic decision at the time, was it, in the early 70s and the movement throughout the 60s to join? It was an emotional one. It was a romantic dream.
Well, as I just said, it was about the war must never happen again. It was the revulsion of the slaughter that created the European movement. Now, we've built on those traditions. I mean, people say to me, what has Europe achieved? One of the first things I say is we've created parliamentary democracy across the continent. We've got rid of the fascists in Spain and Portugal. We've got rid of the colonels in Greece. We have parliamentary institutions. Of course, people sneer at them and say, well, it's bureaucracy and it takes time and there are rules. For goodness sake, what is civilization without rules? What is parliamentary democracy without institutions and the civil service to make it work? And it is a tragedy to me beyond peradventure that There won't even be so much as an empty chair to represent Britain's essential interests in our largest marketplace.
Well, having spent your entire political life fighting for the European project, how did you feel at 12:28 p.m. on Wednesday when Article 50 was finally triggered?
The biggest loss of power and prestige and influence for this country, the biggest abdication of British self-interest in my lifetime, in my peacetime lifetime.
So why did the British people fall out of love with the concept? I mean, the British people simply did not buy that argument any longer and said so on June the 23rd last year.
Yes, but I think that you then have to look a little wider across the world. And what is happening in the more prosperous economies? In this country, we've had the aftermath of the 2008 crash, and we've had levels of immigration of a size that is difficult to absorb. And so people like Nigel Farage appeared on the scene, and with the help of one or two of our larger newspapers, they exploited the passions that arose from that. That was the beginning of the Brexit situation here. But it's not just about Europe. What do you think Donald Trump is? It's the same argument, the same basic instinct politics, the cheap headline that appeals to the beer enthusiasts of some of Britain's public houses. Marie Le Pen in France, what do you think she's on about? Exactly the same thing, the underlying racialism, the intolerance of immigrants. People want alibis, and the easy alibi for us was Europe.
But maybe the populists are to blame. Maybe newspapers have some responsibilities. Maybe even the beer in the public houses have something to do with this. But is there not also some blame for the European elite, of which you were considered one, for simply not taking the people with them in this project and not making people feel a part of it?
Obviously, we have to accept a responsibility in that we didn't win the referendum. But on the other hand, when millions of British people who are concerned about the health service are told that if they vote to leave Europe, there'll be £350 million a week, every week, for the health service, it is understandable if some of them fell for it.
Article 50 is irreversible. That's been established.
Oh, no, I don't agree with that.
Well, the Supreme Court established that with the great debate we had over many, many weeks at the start of this year. Both sides accepted that there is no going back. How do you see
I don't agree with that. I don't think that that is a legally established position. And I, in any case, don't believe that the legality is the important point. If there were to be a view, and it's a big if, that Britain wanted to change its mind, I think that Europe, with a sigh of relief, would say, well, that's very welcome and we're delighted. And so let's continue where we were.
The only way we could stay in or go back in is with another referendum, though, isn't it?
You can't. No, you could do it with an election. You could do it simply by Parliament changing its mind. I'm not saying that these things will happen, but the referendum rerun is one option. So it's simply naive to think that one referendum run under promises which are patently untrue is binding for all time on British democracy.
Lord Heseltine on the European Dream. Conservative peer Lord Hill was Britain's EU commissioner in Brussels at the time of the referendum last year and lost the best job he ever had because of it. He worked for John Major in No. 10 during the Maastricht battles of the early 1990s as well, and he takes a different view from Lord Heseltine. Unlike other EU members, Britain was never really in love with the European Dream in the first place. Where was he, I asked, on the day of last year's big vote?
I was up the road in Westminster voting. I came back to the UK to vote in the referendum and went to bed believing that I'd waked in the morning to Britain having voted to remain to stay in the EU.
And your job would be intact?
Well, next morning, the Friday morning, I took the first train back to Brussels when the result was clear. I went back and then resigned because I felt it was extremely important on the back of something as significant, as decisive as that, that people should see that things didn't just carry on the same.
And what was it like for you going back on that train to Brussels, knowing that these sort of trips between London and Brussels really would now be formally coming to an end?
Well, I think in a way, the thing that was most striking was the mood that I found when I got back to Brussels, because I think already you could see straight away, alongside the mix of shock and sadness and disappointment, it was quite an emotional time, the sense that Britain's influence in that system had ended with that vote. And it's an influence-based system, it's a relationship-based system. And with that vote, that process started to change and our influence started to wane.
As a commissioner in Brussels, did you ever foresee this moment coming? Britain has never been wholly in love with the European project. The frustration was clearly building in this country for years over the red tape and the arguments and the fact we didn't often seem to win. Did you see this moment coming?
One of the things I learnt while I was there was the different way in which I think we've always looked at it. For every other country, for the other 27, they all felt that being part of the EU had given them something. It had given them perhaps stability or prosperity or the rule of law or self-respect or somewhere to go after they'd escaped from communism. And I think for us, when I look back at it, we'd always felt that we'd had those things. And so for us, it was always different. And I think that when I look at it now, the vote in some ways was a long time coming.
Have you always been slightly more Eurosceptic on the long, great spectrum of the Tory party? Where were you on that spectrum pre the referendum?
I would probably describe myself as a sceptic in the old proper sense of the word, not with the meaning that it's come to have, where a Eurosceptic has actually come to mean I hate Europe, whereas I would...
Well, I hate the European Union. I'm sure they would be quick to correct you.
They probably would. Whereas my view was to try and see the purpose behind it, but also to be live to many of the practical challenges that came with it. So I wasn't, for instance, in favour of Britain going into the euro. I campaigned against Britain going into the euro. I think that the question of the future of the European Union, whether it goes down an integrationist route or whether, as I would have argued, it should go down a route whereby you try to devolve more power back to member states, you know, maybe that's an indication of how I think about it.
Many Eurosceptics in the new and old sense of the word name Maastricht, the Maastricht Treaty in the early 90s, as the moment that they decided that the EU had stopped being a trading bloc and really begun to be a superstate. You were working for John Major, number 10 at the time. You ran his political operation. Did you get a sense at the time that Maastricht may just be going too far for British people alone?
Well, you'll remember the debate at the time was around, you know, a number of the opt-outs that John Major secured from the Maastricht Treaty, including one on the single currency. So I think that is a reflection of the fact that people were aware then that Britain saw itself differently from other countries and were alive to concerns around what the future direction might be. I think there is a sense in Britain that something that people thought was its primary purpose might be economic has turned into something beyond that, and that people felt that that wasn't what they'd signed up to. I think it's difficult to attribute it to a single cause. I think if you look back and ask yourself, when was the last time that people made an argument in favour, despite many of the frustrations or some of the benefits that have come in terms of trade and in terms of peace and prosperity, that argument's not been made for a long time in the UK. And in my party in particular, I think we have slipped into a position of fairly relentless criticism of Europe, and everything that people don't like has been kind of blamed on Europe. It's become a shorthand. One of the good things about voting to leave is that our politicians now in Westminster are not going to have anyone else to blame. Our public aren't going to have anyone else to blame, which is the whole idea, I guess, behind, you know, Westminster sovereignty, that in future people are going to have to take responsibility for their decisions and not shuffle off the blame onto other people.
Lord Hill on Where the Buck Will Stop Now. As of 12:28 p.m. last Wednesday, the clock began ticking. Unless all 28 members agree to extend talks, which Theresa May has already said she will not do, when Big Ben strikes midnight on March 30th, 2019, Britain will be out of the European Union. That's just 2 years to strike three deals with the EU, unprecedented in size and complexity. A divorce settlement, a new trading relationship, and a transitional agreement on how to arrive at it smoothly. Plus, have all three ratified by parliaments all across the continent, including our own. It's also just 2 years to make sure Britain has the full legal and regulatory framework to govern itself alone. Brexit Secretary David Davis made it clear on Thursday, as he unveiled the Great Repeal Bill, that means wading through 52,000 different EU laws and then transferring which ones we want to keep onto our own statute. And all that was before Theresa May was dealt a first setback on Friday, when the EU Council's Donald Tusk confirmed there must first be sufficient progress on agreeing a divorce deal before talks on trade can even open.
Starting parallel talks on all issues at the same time, as suggested by some in the UK, will not happen.
So are all these Herculean tasks really all doable in such a comparably short timescale? Two leading figures from the opposite ends of the Brexit debate tried to thrash that out. Brexit High Priest and former Tory leader Ian Duncan-Smith and devout Remainer Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's former Director of Communications. First, Ian Duncan-Smith on the Great Repeal Bill.
I do believe that is doable, but it requires, if we're going to do it in the timescale available, discipline, self-discipline from the government and self-discipline from parliamentarians. The problem will arise if people lose that discipline and start saying, do you know what, while we're doing this, let's change this or that. Because the moment you start doing that, then it opens up a massive debate and a row.
So the argument's got to be self. By people, you mean MPs or the government?
Both. I was in touch with some people the other day that said in the Department for Agriculture, they were suddenly musing about whether or not they needed to have certain things now that they were doing the bill. And my answer was, don't touch. Your job is to transpose, it's not to review. You can review later on and Parliament can have a decision and a debate about whether it needs to change stuff, but not before we leave the European Union. That has to be as seamless as possible.
Alistair Campbell, all we need is a little bit of iron discipline for the nation, on behalf of the nation, and everyone will be fine.
This is La La Land. I think if you look at very straightforward issues, the number of skilled negotiators that we have against what we're going to be up against, the unity, brackets lack of, I think, around the cabinet table. I know that we have a sense of them being united, but my very, very clear impression from talking to some of the people I talk to is that actually there isn't a real sense of unity. People are genuinely worried about the route that Mrs. May is taking them down. And from day one, the day that she triggered Article 50, several of the big claims that she was making for what was going to happen in the next 2 years are clearly falling by the wayside. Angela Merkel, François Hollande, both making clear that this idea that they can sort of, you know, settle the tab as we negotiate new trade deals, that's not going to happen. So I think that if you just think that it takes an average seven, often longer, 10 years, to negotiate a complicated trade deal, we are going to have to negotiate a whole stack of them. And then there's all these bodies that we're part of, that we're no longer going to be part of, and what sort of regime we put in place for them. So I think we're talking, even before you get onto this great repeal business of all the legislation that's going to have to be unpicked. And I don't think it's fair to expect MPs to say, well, we're just going to sort of nod that through, given all the issues that are contained within that and the capacity for government to change.
Ian Duncan-Smith, just on the point of what we need to make all this work within this two-year time frame, it's not just iron discipline amongst our own MPs or our government, it's also huge reliance on 27 EU countries, is it not?
Yeah. I was dealing specifically with the question about the bill. And so I absolutely do believe that's doable. Now, if you run in parallel with that, what we're going to do with our discussions and negotiations with the European Union, I do believe it's feasible to reach a point at the end of the 2 years, 18 months applicability in 2 years, of an arrangement with us. But if you ask me, will there continue to be further discussions? The answer is yes, beyond the 2 years, because these things will be constantly moving and changing. But the key question is, you reach a point at the end of that 2 years, which means as we leave, we have an arrangement with the European Union about our trade, about financial services, about accessibility, about citizens, all of those key elements that they'll be looking at. Now, Schäuble was on the other day, about 3 weeks ago, and he said categorically, and he must have been licensed.
German finance minister.
He must have been licensed. He's very close to Mrs. Merkel. He was licensed to do this, and I'm told by a number of people. He said categorically, let's be clear from the outset, we need to reach the end of this two-year period an arrangement with the United Kingdom that recognises the unique and special position that it has as our major trading partner and our need for the City of London not just to survive, but to prosper with the UK outside of the European Union. He was very explicit about that. So I think you're going to find a lot more of reaching of quite a lot of common ground in all of this when we get down to the discussions.
Alistair Campbell, are you not slightly guilty of wanting this to be a very pessimistic outcome because you quite clearly don't want Brexit to work?
I don't enjoy being pessimistic, but I am deeply pessimistic. I mean, Theresa May said she wants the country to unite. I don't see any way that this ends well, economically, politically, for what we are as a country. If you look at the trade deal that the European Union was doing with the Canadians, which was held up for ages over one sort of small Hungarian issue, and all of these countries are going to have an awful lot of say, and I don't think we should pretend that they're going to be sitting there wishing us ill, but nor are they terribly going to be wishing us well. And I think that they are looking at it from their own self-interest. If there's no deal and we fall back on WTO only, then we have to accept, you have to accept, that 90% of goods that we are currently sending out there are going to be subject to tariffs. Some of them very, very high.
Politicians, and you know this, when it comes down to it, they actually in the end want to settle. Ideologues don't win this. Pragmatism does.
Well, ideologues won the referendum.
Yeah, but they make the deals.
Can I just ask, finally, on a personal level, you two represent the two extremes of this argument, if you don't mind me using
Stop
that word.
Brexit.
Stop Brexit, Brexit full speed ahead. Will you reconcile yourself with Alistair?
I'm always reconciled with Alistair.
It sounds like he has to come to you.
The door is always open.
Ian Duncan Smith's door is open.
Right,
where
lovely.
Are you going to walk through it?
Lovely. I think more and more people are going to get more and more angry, and at the end of this deal, they will want some sort of say. And I reckon I trust the pragmatism of the British people to admit when we've made a mistake.
Don't you think, Alistair, that the British people get angrier if a group of you continue to constantly say
they
we
might.
Don't accept your decision?
No, I do accept the decision.
And we want you to
decision,
think again. And my point is, well, that's what you're saying. Actually, the British people, I think, have accepted this. And if you talk to business, they're not now saying, we need this, we want that, we want that.
A lot are.
What a business is actually saying is, we want to know where we're going to be because
right.
we have to price
but
that.
But a lot are
that's
saying that.
No reconciliation just yet, then. Alistair Campbell and Ian Duncan Smith on if Brexit is doable in 2 years. As momentous as it was, triggering Article 50 was not the only challenge for Westminster to wrestle with this week. Parliament and all who work in it were still very much recovering from the deeply traumatic events of last week's terrorism attack. After it was quite swiftly established that Khalid Massoud acted alone, the debate moved on to what more could be done to stop future attacks. And it was the giant tech companies who faced renewed wrath. Massoud used the encrypted platform WhatsApp just 2 minutes before he launched his bloody rampage. Home Secretary Amber Rudd seized on MI5's problem to apply extra pressure on the tech companies to fulfil the government's long-running demand for them to do more in the fight against terrorism.
It is completely unacceptable. There should be no place for terrorists to hide. We need to make sure that organisations like WhatsApp, and there are plenty of others like that, don't provide a secret place for terrorists to communicate with each other.
Where should the line be drawn? Former independent terrorism laws reviewer Lord Carlisle joined me in the studio, along with Labour's shadow minister for the digital economy, Louise Haig, to share their views. I asked Alex Carlisle if the British government will ever succeed in dictating to internet companies based abroad.
The law that was introduced last year was debated in far more detail than any other act of Parliament I have known in my 30-odd years as a member of one House or the other of Parliament. The powers are absolutely clear, but the government cannot take the arm of the manager of one of those companies and force that arm onto a particular button. Cooperation is required. And my advice to the internet companies is, even bearing in mind that the British Parliament only has jurisdiction to introduce laws for the United Kingdom, they would be well advised to be cooperative. Otherwise, Parliament will react against them and produce laws which might impinge on the freedom of speech. We are a long way from that at the moment.
Louise Haig, surely that's right, isn't it? Security, people's lives, people's safety should always trump freedom of speech and the right to express yourself.
Well, I think anything that breaches the law or breaches national security, that incites hatred, whether that's religious or racial, should obviously have action taken against it.
And Amber Rudd is also very hard over on the internet companies about when that content is encrypted, when people are talking to each other under encryption on sites like WhatsApp.
Watching Amber Rudd's interviews last weekend, I think she got herself into a bit of confusion about what she meant here. It was a fairly knee-jerk reaction to the horrific events in Westminster last week. The individual in question wasn't part of the intelligence picture, so ending end-to-end encryption would not have made the slightest bit of difference as to preventing that attack.
But it might have prevented a future one if we'd known what various people were saying with each other.
But as Lord Carlisle said, we've just had an enormous piece of legislation that was very controversial, that was debated extensively by both sides of the House, that brought in the tech sector and came up with actually what is probably quite a decent piece of legislation that gives our intelligence services and the Home Office extensive power to collect internet records, to install devices and malware on electronic devices in order to monitor communications. There really seems to me no need to look at end-to-end encryption. And the government was very clear during the passage of that bill that they would do nothing to undermine encryption. GCHQ advises the industry at the moment to encrypt their communications.
Why should the law allow two different people trying to plot terror and mayhem as free space to do it just because it happens to be under encryption?
It doesn't.
But that's what's happening now.
It doesn't. Our intelligence services have the ability to request a warrant to seize either the sender or the receiver's phone. It allows our intelligence services to request a warrant to install malware, to be able to view the messages in real time. There's absolutely no need.
But not if those messages are encrypted. No one can view those. That's the point of them.
Well, but they can if they have access to the phone.
I mean, the issue about encryption is an issue of logic, and I agree entirely with Louise Haig that the law actually provides for WhatsApp to be required to provide information if they're asked for it. It's completely illogical that a company like WhatsApp, because it has end-to-end encryption, should relieve itself of the requirements of the law. And I think it's worth adding at this point, because this issue often arises in other people's minds, that the idea that the security services, because they haven't got enough to do, are going to look at your or my credit card transactions or ordinary email transactions is an absurdity. We have to recognise that the authorities are extremely pushed, and the issue is whether they have sufficient resources to do their job properly.
But the argument is it not giving or asking WhatsApp to have a backdoor into their encrypted messages gives a backdoor into anyone else,
absolutely.
Criminals, hackers, yeah. The lot.
Well, that's why WhatsApp and others who have end-to-end encryption must cooperate with not just our government, the governments of France, Italy, Germany, United States and so on, so that the public can be protected. Otherwise, we are going to see mothers on their way to collect their children from school being mown down by terrorists, police officers who are protecting the public suffering the same, and the other victims whose histories are well known from last week.
So, Louise Haig, do you agree? Should internet companies cooperate more? Should WhatsApp do more then?
I think certainly all the tech companies could be doing much more. I think Google is quite notorious
amongst
the police.
What should WhatsApp do on encryption?
Encryption technology has not progressed since we debated the IP bill, and we did debate end-to-end encryption at length during its passage through Parliament, so I don't see any need to revisit it now. The fact of the matter is that terror attack last week was about the least technological attack he could have made. He jumped in his car with a knife, and Lord Carlisle makes the important point that resources are absolutely crucial to the investigation of that, that our neighbourhood policing and our intelligence services need to be properly resourced, and that's the only way that we can prevent attacks like that happening in the future.
Louise Haig and Alex Carlisle on the internet companies and terrorism. You've been listening to the Week in Westminster podcast with me, Tom Newton-Dunn. In a few weeks' time, when Parliament returns, Sam Coates from The Times will be here.